Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us. This should be a fun hour. We're talking about the art and science of homebrewing beer. 3,000 homebrewers are in Baltimore this week for Homebrew Con, the 38th annual conference of the National Homebrewers Association. They're attending seminars on everything from brewing in ancient Greece to the science of beer foam. They're learning about obscure strains of hops and malts and yeast, and of course, they're drinking beer. Beer is one of our oldest beverages. The ancient Egyptians flavored theirs with dates and honey. Hops first appeared during the Middle Ages when people drank a lot of ale and beer. And in this country, homebrewing has been practiced since colonial times. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson both fermented their own beer. The modern era of homebrewing started in the 1960s, but really took hold in the 1990s. In 2005, the American Homebrewers Association had 9,000 members. Now it has 46,000. In Maryland alone, there are at least 16 different homebrew clubs. The conference has made such a splash that yesterday Governor Hogan stopped by for a beer. What's behind the rise in homebrewing enthusiasts? How easy is it to get started? Are there really beers brewed with salt water? We prevailed on two knowledgeable homebrewers to take time away from the homebrewing conference to fill us in on the trends. Steve Parr is Assistant Director of the American Homebrewers Association. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad you could be here. And Chris Anderson is a longtime homebrewer and general manager of Maryland Homebrew, a supply store in Columbia. So glad you could join us.
Thank you.
So you guys showed up with bottles of beer, and my heart is touched because the name of this beer, which is an India Pale Lager, the name is Airwaves. What's the story behind this beer, Steve?
That's right. So this is actually the commemorative beer that all the 3,000 attendees at HomebrewCon are receiving as attending the event. And so the story goes, it was actually the current head brewer of Flying Dog Brewing Company, one of the largest breweries in the state here in Maryland.
Who is that?
His name is Matt Brophy. And he was listening to the radio long ago before he started brewing, and he heard a radio interview that was going on with our founder, Charlie Papazian, talking about this awesome, cool new hobby of homebrewing, and it inspired him to start making his own beer. So fast forward to today, we're bringing the conference to Maryland, and we were trying to look for an idea for our commemorative beer. What better yet than bringing together the two guys, Charlie Papazian and Matt Brophy, who Charlie having inspired Matt, who's now a professional brewer, to collaborate on this beer.
And it's called Airwaves.
It's called Airwaves.
I get that Matt Brophy was inspired by a radio interview.
Yes, to start homebrewing, which kind of launched his career to become a professional brewer. And so we see that nowadays where actually a lot of today's craft beer success stories started off as homebrewers.
Right, and I want to talk to you a lot more about that. But I first want to understand how you get the concept, how he got the concept of Airwaves into a beer. What is it about? I don't have a church key here, so I haven't opened this beer. Haven't tasted it.
I got one right here for you.
Okay, I don't know whether I don't know whether the FCC allows this, but
we're okay.
We're okay. We're gonna sip this beer. But tell me what it is that went into this beer. What? Because ingredients is something else I want to talk to you about. Thank you, Chris. Ingredients is something else I want to talk to you about. What is it that makes this beer somehow the right beer to drink when you're talking about a radio interview?
Well, it was the idea that it was this radio interview talking about homebrewing and this cool new hobby that inspired him to go pro. And Matt and Charlie are both hopheads, which kind of led to the ingredients going into this. There's a lot of very
hopheads.
So one of the main ingredients that goes into the brewing process is hops.
Right. And I understand that's actually the cone of a flower.
Yeah,
it's not a grain. I always thought it was a grain.
Nope. Hops are a flower. And we can go into a little bit more about what they go into the brewing process and how they contribute flavor. But some of the really popular varieties that homebrewers and even professional brewers are using today, Citra, Mosaic, Simcoe, Centennial, we used all four of those varieties in making this beer.
And so that's what I'm tasting. I'm tasting something that's tart.
Floral.
I wouldn't call it sweet.
Citrusy. Yes.
Fruity in general, mm-hmm.
Correct.
I would say.
That's from the hops.
Okay.
These are all American hop varieties. And so the style is, it's called an India Pale Lager. You know, we see a lot of India Pale Ales today, but with homebrewers and even with amongst craft brewers, a lot of experimentation and customization and coming up with new styles. And this is kind of one of those where they took something that was really common amongst ales and applied it amongst lagers. You get this really clean, crisp flavor from the lager. and those Pilsner malts, but then you bring in these American hops that oftentimes, again, were used in IPAs, but they threw it in that lager, so you get a lot of that citrus.
I'm getting lost, because you know all these. But when you say IPA, you know exactly. And what I've read about IPAs is lots of hops, right?
Correct.
So I kind of have that connection, but you're sort of blending.
IPA is India Pale Ale. Ales ferment on the top of the fermentation when you're making it, and lager is a different type of yeast that ferments at the bottom. So lagers like to ferment cooler than ales, which ferment closer to room temperature, but you get a cleaner, crisper taste, as Steve was referring to, with the lager yeast.
Okay. Let me backtrack, because you mentioned craft beers. Obviously, this is a craft beer. Steve Parr, what is the appeal of, for so many people, more than a million people in America, brewing their own beer when there's such a variety of craft beers available, you know, like this bottled
beer
right.
that
you brought us?
We have more than 1.2 million people in America right now that are making their own beer. That's more than one in 200 adults, which is pretty amazing. Just in the last few years, we've had a lot of people that have gotten into the homebrewing hobby, and part of that is just being introduced to craft beer and that idea of full-flavored, really well-produced quality beer.
But why do people drink a craft beer and think, I got to make it myself?
I think it's the idea that this is something that I can create myself, right? And the idea that I can customize all of these flavors and all these different types of ingredients to make something that I really enjoy. And the access to quality brewing information, access to quality brewing ingredients has grown so much just in the last 5 to 10 years that more and more people have been exposed to homebrewing through craft beer. And that idea that, you know, many of our homebrewing members, even though they're making it themselves, they're also some of the biggest supporters of their local craft breweries as well. So they're making it as well as drinking at the same time. It's just part of that overall consumption and just idea of creating something that they like. I think a good example is, you know, any other hobby where you're making something that you find a reward in, like photography or cooking. Homebrewing applies the same way.
Chris, how did you get involved in homebrewing?
I was dating a gentleman, and I really like to cook. And I was like, well, that seems awful lot like cooking. So show me how. And I kind of got the advanced course with brewing. And that was 18 years ago.
So, and it sucked you in, and it appealed to you for the same reason that cooking appealed to you.
That's correct. And I've always been a beer person. So I've always enjoyed
drinking
beer. Yes. So I was like, well, why not make it? You know, I enjoy, like I said, cooking. And so it's best of both worlds, cooking and drinking.
And what has kept you involved in homebrewing all these years?
The community, mostly. I think it's a great community. Like you said, I'm the general manager for Maryland Homebrew. I was a customer there, and I said I could help them out a couple days a week, and that was 16 years ago. Now I run the business. So so that's kind of kept me in there, but I'm also very involved with the homebrewing community, and it's like a family. So a lot of people that do homebrew, like myself, are foodies, I would say. They also enjoy cooking. They're passionate about the flavors, the smells, and so
I think that do-it-yourself culture really comes into play here, where we've seen that really grow a whole
lot
in popularity.
That's what I was looking for.
You know, especially, you know, in like the millennial generation. We see a lot of millennials actually right now getting into homebrewing with that idea of making it yourself, right? And this really plays into that. Another, I think, example is, well, I mean, again, you know, cooking, photography, art. But when we talk about food and caring about where your products are coming from, you know, grilled cheese, right? You used to do it with like Wonder Bread and like Kraft Singles. Well, nowadays people are looking at like their local bread producers and like these
artisanal
local
bread
cheese artisans.
And special
and you're
cheese
going now to restaurants, and they're making these types of products that aren't those kind of traditional prepackaged, you know, pre-made, you know, standard brand foods, where, you know, the story of it being locally sourced and it being really special and something that you had a role in really plays well with local consumers nowadays.
That is Steve Parr, Assistant Director of the American Homebrewers Association, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me here in the studio is Chris Anderson, General Manager of Maryland Homebrew, a supply store in Columbia. She is a longtime homebrewer. You can be part of this conversation. Are you a homebrewer? What do you love about it? Why is it worth the effort when there are so many great craft beers available commercially? Call us at 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Steve, I want to get back to craft beers.
Sure.
Because I mean, is this sort of the progression you described with Matt Brophy? Started home brewing, becomes a professional brewer.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen a lot?
Yeah, I mean, we're up to, we have more than 4,300 craft breweries in the United States nowadays. We're actually at a point where we're averaging more than two new breweries in the U.S. every single day. And we're not really showing any signs of that stopping. And a lot of this is coming from that rise in popularity of homebrewing. And so in 1978, homebrewing was legalized federally. And we saw that that was kind of that initial spawn of people making their own beers that were providing flavors different than what was already commercially available post-prohibition. You know, there was a lot of those light American lagers around, but homebrewing allowed people to make something new. And so, you know, kind of spawning from that late 70s, kind of into the 80s and 90s, we started seeing people open up breweries.
Chris Anderson, you told our producer, Andrea Appleton, that the relationship between craft brewers and homebrewers is incestuous. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask you to explain that.
Sure. Well, just as Steve was saying, I have seen a bunch of homebrewers come to the store, get started, and go off to be professional brewers. So we have that relationship with them when they come into the store as homebrewers, and that relationship continues as they go on to be commercial brewers. So If we're in a bind and need something, they're there to help us out, and vice versa. They come and get their test batches from us, and we give them lots of good feedback, and with sampling, of course. And also, some of them will ask us to check out recipes. If they're in a bind and they can't find certain ingredients, we'll help them. If something's happened with something at the store and we need something, they'll help us. And we always work together at the beer festivals, and they will have us in to have events at their place. So it's really, it's just the growth of the family and the homebrewing and craft beer industry. It's really great.
I read a profile of you that gave me the impression that you're not at all interested in running your own brewery.
No, I am. I'm not.
So you really are enjoying this mothering role that you do with homebrewers.
And a lot of people say that of me, that I'm the mother, so.
But so what, I mean, as Steve told us, lots of people go through homebrewing to run their own breweries. That's not your thing.
Because I guess I like seeing them all grow up and go on to do that better thing, or they stay with us for years. I've been there for 16 years, and there's customers that have been there since before me, and you just get that bond. And I don't want them to not have this home to come to and get all their ingredients and the knowledge that they seek from myself and my employees.
We're going to take a quick break here. It'll give me a chance to take another sip of Airwaves, and it'll give you a chance to think of what your questions are for our guests. Are you interested in brewing your own beer? What would you like to know about the process? We have two really well-informed people with us here in the studio, and you can be part of the conversation if you call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about home brewing. The 38th Annual National Home Brewing Conference wraps up in Baltimore tomorrow. Longtime Maryland home brewer Chris Anderson, general manager of a homebrew supply store in Columbia, is with us in studio, and so is Steve Parr, Assistant Director of the American Homebrewers Association. What about you? If you're a homebrewer, what is the weirdest beer you've ever made? The best. You can share your accomplishments with us if you email us at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Steve Parr, there are beers that taste like champagne and beers that are so fruity they could be cider. What makes a beer a beer?
What makes a beer a beer? Wow. Well, I guess if we look at it from a bird's eye view, there's four main ingredients that go into the brewing process. Obviously, water plays a huge role. It's going to make up 98% of our product. And then we're going to look at malt, hops, and yeast. So we can go into those a little bit more detail. But amongst those four ingredients in varying combinations, we can make nearly any style of beer that's out there. Obviously, we as homebrewers aren't limited to just those four types of ingredients. And we've seen a lot of homebrewers and even craft brewers start to experiment with what you can add. And so, I mean, you talked about some of those fruity flavors, or if you want oakiness, you know, you can actually put fruit and oak into your beer. And so we're not limited.
I can understand how a beverage can pick up an oaky flavor from being in oak, but how do you add it as a flavor to beer?
Same exact way.
You put in wood?
Yeah, pretty much. So the same way that like wine is going to be in a French oak barrel, we have breweries nowadays that are actually taking used wine barrels or used whiskey barrels or even tequila and gin barrels or just unused oak and different varieties of, you know, chars and different types of oak. And you can age your beer on that oak, whether it be in the barrel or you're going to Chris's shop and you're buying oak cubes or oak spirals.
So you mentioned malt, hops, and yeast.
Yes.
Walk me, one of you, maybe Chris, you should do this. Walk me through the simplest process. If I've never brewed at home before and I want to.
A batch of beer, if you were to come into the shop and we were going to help you get started, we would start you out the simplest way, which would be extracts that come in two forms, either a molasses-y type consistency or a sticky powder consistency. And that's your sugar and your malt flavor.
You can buy them together.
You can buy them. Some recipes have them together or separate. And then you also have a little bit of the grains that will give you color and flavor. And you steep that in a little cheesecloth bag for 20 to 30 minutes at like 150 degrees. You take those out. You add some of those extracts. You do an hour-long boil where you add hops at different times according to the recipe, just like you're making a soup. And then you cool it down and add your yeast and let it ferment for a couple weeks.
And you can do all that just with the equipment you have in your kitchen?
You need a 20-quart stock pot and your stove, and you're good to go.
So after you've done, after it sits, I mean, first of all, what do you put it in to keep it for a couple of
weeks?
For
fermentation process, you put it in regular, they're called ale pails at my store, but buckets with graduation marks so you know how many gallons you have, or what we call carboys, which just look like big glass or plastic jugs, kind of like the water bottles that dispense the water in different offices and things.
Oh, okay. And
they have a little bubbler on top that the CO2 that's made from the fermentation comes out of the little airlock, but nothing can get in. No bad bacteria or gnats or anything like that will get into that sweetness. Mm.
We like to say at the AHA, if you can make soup, then you can make homebrew.
That's really what we say at the store.
You're boiling liquid. You're adding ingredients to that boiling liquid. You're letting it cool down. You're making sure that all the utensils and equipment that you're using is sanitized, because you wouldn't put your food in a dirty container. And then we're basically letting the yeast do all the work from there.
So, and the yeast takes, we're talking weeks, not months.
The yeast fermentation, we like to give it its enough time to complete everything that it needs to do, but fermentation is typically done within anywhere from 10 to 14 days.
So this is how most homebrewers start out?
That's correct.
Most of the stuff you need, you really already have at home, and the rest of the equipment, you can just go to your local homebrew supply shop.
And Chris Anderson, what are the most common mistakes beginning homebrewers make?
Sure. The biggest one, as Steve mentioned, is sanitization. Everything that comes in contact with that, what's called wort before you add the yeast.
Wort.
Yes. It's W-O-R-T, pronounced W-E-R-T. And everything that comes in contact with it after the boil needs to be sanitized. So if you forget and shove a spoon in to stir it up or something and it wasn't sanitized, then bacteria that's just in the air can get in there and give your beer an off flavor. Temperatures for fermentation are also very important. If it's really hot and the yeast doesn't like it that hot in your house, it'll produce esters or fusel flavors that are like that warm burning down your throat. The esters will be can be very fruity. You can get flavors like a Band-Aid from bad fermentation. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, check your fermentation and make sure everything's sanitized.
So I did enough reading to know that the process you're describing using extracts is considered sort of the beginner's process.
That's correct.
And it's more, it's a bit more sophisticated, more complicated to do all grain mm-hmm. brewing. So, Steve, what is that like?
So I think a good way to put it is that homebrewing can be as simple or as easy as you want it to be. And while we do like to introduce people to extracts because extracts serving as your form of malt, malt's going to be your main source of sugar and flavor for the beer. Another way to do it is you brew all grain, where you're taking the malted barley that's going to contain all the starches that during a process called mashing is going to be converting those starches into sugars, which will then serve as a source for fermentation. That malt extract is basically a concentrated version of that entire process done for you. And so, again, when we're introducing people to the hobby or to the activity, extract is a way to eliminate some of those variables, and it's also actually going to speed up your brew day, too. And so even when we're talking to advanced brewers, people that have been brewing for a long time, if you just have a short time in the afternoon and you want to get in a quick brew day, extract's a viable option for that. So it's not necessarily just for beginners, either. But again, so it's going to be your source of the malt sugars providing fermentation for your beer.
That is Steve Parr, Assistant Director of the American Homebrewers Association here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Chris Anderson, General Manager of Maryland Homebrew, a homebrew supply store in Columbia, is also here in the studio. And you can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or email us at midday@wypr.org. Laura in Glen Arm has emailed us. She says, my husband brews his own beer. It's a great opportunity for him and his friends to be together for hours on end on a Saturday afternoon, brainstorming recipes, grinding grain, bringing the mash to boil, etc. If only they would stick around for the cleanup. That was in parentheses. Mm-hmm. They even brewed the beer for our wedding reception. The waiting is the hardest part, a couple of weeks until it's ready to drink. So that's Laura's summary of what it's like
yep.
to be in the catbird seat watching home brewing. Is that a pretty typical reaction?
Sure.
Think so. And we do get a lot of people that will make wedding beer. Beer for their wedding, beer for their children's wedding, for their great friend's wedding. And then they like to bottle it and have special labels, or they'll just take kegs of it, depending on how fancy the wedding is, I guess. But presents also, it makes great presents, party favors, wedding favors. We see a lot of that.
I think that's an important part of the story to tell, because as homebrewers, we've developed this culture of sharing, where we're not only sharing the brewing process and the story of brewing, but we're sharing our products. And that's carried over into craft beer. But just, again, sharing your beer, whether it be weddings or whether it be your Super Bowl party or the backyard barbecue. I mean, we see all different types of events in human history where people have, you know, invited each other over a bottle of beer.
Well, what are the rules, the legal rules about how much you can brew before you're in business and you need licenses or whatever?
Sure. So in the United States, a family within a household can produce up to 200 gallons annually.
200 gallons?
200 gallons.
That's a lot of beer.
It's a lot of beer. It's up to you to track that.
But that's a family. That's not a per person. That's per family. That's per...
Correct.
Per brewing unit.
Correct.
Does this vary by state?
That is the federal law. So homebrewing was federally legalized in 1978. From 1978 on, it actually took a little bit of time at the state level to legalize homebrewing. It wasn't until 2013 when we had all 50 states.
Huh. And so that amount being able to be brewed without special licenses or it pretty much covers the wedding, brewing for parties, et cetera.
Correct. Yes.
It's for personal use.
So you can't charge for it?
Correct.
No. You would have to have a license to charge for it. The normal batch size for a home brewer is generally 5 to 10 gallons. So takes a you have a little bit of room there.
Chris Anderson, Laura's query about being married to a home brewer focuses me on, I would think a lot of our listeners assume that home brewing is primarily a male hobby.
That's true. Women are definitely getting into the industry more and into the hobby more. When I started off 16 years ago, I really had to prove myself to the customers that were there before me. They were like, "Where's that guy that used to help me all the time?" And, you know, "What do you know about beer? You're just a girl." So I was like,
How did you deal with that?
I said, "Well, you know, give me a shot. Ask me a question." And they were fairly impressed by my knowledge of brewing. And one person in particular that did become a good friend was, I think I won him over by winning a competition for an English mild, a style of beer that he feels and a lot of other people feel is tough to brew.
English mild.
Yes.
Why is it tough to brew?
So the boyfriend that I had at the time that taught me how to brew, we brewed it together, but it's low everything, low alcohol, mild flavor, low hops. So there's not a lot of room for mistake and error because there's not a lot of those flavors to cover mistakes up.
So I'm completely confused about why one would go to the trouble of brewing something that is low in flavor.
And they're not very popular today. People like a lot more flavor and some people even a lot higher alcohol than like a 4 or 4.5% beer. It's kind of an old school, old, you know, over on the other side of the pond beer. And it's just that challenge. You enjoy trying to see what you can do.
So I understand, Chris Anderson, that you were involved in forming a group of women involved in
the Baltimore Beer Babes.
Tell me about the Baltimore Beer Babes.
So I'm one of the founding people in this. There are three other women that are on the in charge of the club. We are a women-based group that educates women about beer because we do want to see more women in the industry and in the hobby. And we have quarterly events that are happy hour events, and we try and keep costs down. We do brewing classes. We do different styles and what makes them that style of beer, whether it's a Belgian-style beer or German-style. We'll cover that kind of country. We'll have cooking with beer, pairing with beer, what hops taste like. We've done a yeast series, so it's the same beer brewed, the base, and then all different yeast added to it, so you can see all the nuances from all the different strains of yeast, or the same beer with different hops in it, so you can learn what the different flavors are you're tasting.
Steve, I have no doubt that the association welcomes women and treats them fine, but what is your sense of how big you have? You mentioned earlier having a bird's eye view of the brewing process, the bird's eye view of who is involved in home brewing in the U.S. How much of it is women?
You know, I'd say putting a number on it is tough. I'd say if I had to guess, maybe 10 to 15% of the brewing population is female right now. But
I was trying to push it to 20, but we were right in the same area.
I mean, it's growing. It really is. I mean, you go to our events and you look at who's been attending over the last few years. You look at our membership that's been growing, and more women are getting into beer, especially as the perception of beer has changed, you know, as a product. And even traditionally, you look back. You gave a little bit of a history when we started this show. Historically, women were the brewers amongst civilizations.
Alewives.
Yeah. That's the story.
When you say historically, how far back do you have to go to? I mean, are you talking in sort of pre-recorded history, or are you talking about colonial
1900s?
Times?
Oh no, I mean, when you look at some of the recipes and stories being told about beer, because that's how they passed on the information. Again, I don't have the dates. You might know a little better than I do.
I'm thinking it's more colonial.
Colonial times. Yeah. You know, I think it's really within the United States, the post-prohibition kind of mindset that beer's this male-dominated thing. And that's...
You mentioned Prohibition. Was there a lot of home brewing during Prohibition?
Oh, of course. You know, you make alcohol illegal in a country, and then people are going to find ways to make it themselves.
And you think that was primarily a male activity?
Well, I'm not sure if it was necessarily male or female during Prohibition. I'm just saying that home brewing grew in popularity.
I'm just trying to pick up on what you said about post-prohibition. There was kind of an attitude that this was a male thing.
So post-prohibition, you look at the American beer markets, and we were primarily limited to those light American lagers that we all kind of see as like those backyard lawnmower beers that you serve at like tailgate parties. And that's no longer the case, is that beer has a wide variety of flavors and profiles and styles. And the way that a lot of those beers have been advertised and marketed and branded, I think really had appealed to males at that time and point. And we're starting to see that change a little bit more, where they're casting a wider net. And because women really do enjoy beer, and actually, you know, we're doing a lot of work on our professional side when it comes to our craft beer program in terms of, you know, categorizing flavors and styles and some of the just different characteristics that go into beer. Women actually tend to be better tasters than men. And so we're seeing competitions where women are participating and judging, and they're picking out things that, you know, their male counterparts can't always do.
I'm shocked. Let's talk to Tom in Towson. Tom is calling us. Tom, welcome to Midday.
Hi there. How you doing?
Just great. How are you?
Just fine. I guess my story is that I learned beer making as much as I know from my dad. He just passed away a couple years ago at the age of 92. And he learned at least the motivation from it from his dad over in Germany. My dad was born in Germany. And they had an inn in a small town on the Main River near Frankfurt. And that's kind of where it all started. If there's some question near the beginning about what's the motivation for making beer when there are all these wonderful beers out there, and our motivation was always, have you looked at the price?
So it's more economical to make your own?
Well, we were making beer for, I don't know, 40, 50 cents a pint. And, you know, when you're looking at $6, $7, $8, $9 a six-pack for just about any beer that's respectable, there's not a whole lot of choice there.
So, Tom, how long have you been brewing your own?
Let's see. Probably, this is off and on, probably about 15, 20 years. But we have never gotten into the level that the folks on your program are talking about. We did a lot of just going down to the store, the beer store, and getting a mix, you know, getting something that was already in a can and taking it home and then just filling with it to make it a little bit different than it would be if we just did the pre-made kit.
Tom, I appreciate your calling us. Is that what you hear from a lot of people who start? I mean, you know, Tom has it in his DNA from a father who brought brewing skills from Germany, and yet he says he started with a kit.
Cost is definitely something. Starter ingredient kits will range anywhere from $35 to, let's say, $55. It'll make 48 to 53 beers. So you divide that math, it's definitely less expensive. And they can get more expensive, though, with the amount of alcohol content, so you need more sugars, the amount of hops that you add in. The more you add to it, the more expensive the beer. But craft beer is expensive. He said six or seven. I think I've seen $8 to $16 a six-pack. So,
right.
But it's a labor of love.
And that comes through, I think. We're going to take another quick break here. And when we come back, more on making your own great beer and mead and cider in your own home. Join our conversation. Are you looking for tips? Have you ever made your own mead or your own wine? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about the art of home brewing beer. I'm speaking with Chris Anderson, general manager at Maryland Homebrew and an active member of the Maryland homebrew scene. And Steve Parr, Assistant Director for the American Homebrewers Association. You can be part of this conversation. If there's something you'd like to know about brewing your own beer, this is a great chance to get your questions answered by calling us at 410-662-8780 or sending us an email at midday@wypr.org. Jeffrey has written us from Towson. He says, I'm a home brewer in Towson and a longtime customer of Chris. One question I've always struggled with, how long can I keep beer? Is it about the gravity, types of yeast, luck of the draw? So what, Chris,
sure.
Since he's a customer of yours, how would you answer Jeff about how long he can expect to keep beer?
Sure. Different styles of beer are definitely going to age different than others. Beers like wheat beers and lighter beers, you're going to want to drink earlier. Even hoppy beers that might be a little bit stronger, those hops are going to dissipate. For me, I notice it really after even 3 months. The IPAs peak at 6 weeks. Wheat beers, like I said, probably 2 to 3 months. The heavier beers, stouts and porters, and then the higher the alcohol they are, will last a lot longer. 6 months, a year, they're never going to go bad. They're never going to hurt you. Just flavor is going to be lost. The CO2 and the hops will act as a preservative for them. Then
we haven't really talked about physically what you do with the beer after it's fermented. Does everybody put it in bottles and seal it?
I would say that most people do bottle their beer just like this one today. Then there is the next group of people where they keg their beer. So it's the old soda kegs, 5-gallon soda kegs, and you put your beer in there and then you put CO2 on it to make that carbonation.
And so lots of people have a crimping device that so they can put their own caps
bottle cappers,
in.
Yes.
But yeah.
And you put a little bit of sugar in at the time when you bottle it, and the yeast eats the sugar in the bottle under pressure of the bottle cap, which makes your bubbles.
Okay, we have a call from Lamar in Annapolis, who I think has the experience that I would expect. Lamar, thank you for calling.
My one attempt at making a craft beer like this. I went down and bought the kit and the package and everything, came back, and I had a great big pickle crock that had been used to make crocks pickles in. I rinsed it out real well, washed it thoroughly, put everything in there, and waited the 2 or 3 weeks or whatever the brewing time was, and then tasted it. It was unbelievably awful. The pickle juice in the crock had apparently leaked into the beer and totally ruined it.
Yep.
So the comment a while ago about being careful that whatever vessel you're rinsing it in is absolutely clean and hadn't been used for that thing is vitally important.
Lamar, I really appreciate you sharing the story. I want to get straight on two things. One is, was this like a pottery, a ceramic crock, or was it glass, or what?
This was ceramic.
So it had some pores, even
yeah.
though you rinsed it carefully. So that was my first question. My second question is, have you tried again since then using some other?
No, that ended my attempt. I just buy a beer when I need it.
Lamar, I really do appreciate you sharing your story. I must say, Stephen and Chris, when you describe it, it sounds like every batch is going to be great. You're just going to get better and better at it, and it's just an upward climb to become a better and better home brewer. And I'm thinking, really?
Bad batches happen. You do have to be careful. And knock on wood, I haven't had a ton of bad batches, just one or two. You learn from your mistakes and move on. But the ingredients and the equipment have come such a long way that it's made it a lot easier and you can be a lot more successful. The recipes are very easy to follow. And of course, we're here to help you along the way and answer any questions.
We haven't talked much about ingredients, but I saw some amazing topics in the program for the homebrew conference.
Sure.
Tell us about some of the more unusual ingredients that people use. I read about cucumbers, for example.
Oh my, yes. I mean, really, if you can cook with it, you can probably find a way to put it in beer. You know, tonight we have one of our social events for HomebrewCon, and it's called Club Nights. We have 70 different clubs from around the country that are coming to pour their beers. And there's probably anywhere from 5 to 15 different beers being poured by each of these different clubs. And one of the things these homebrewers love to do is experiment and try new ingredients. And some of them find great ways to incorporate something you would never consider ever putting in something that you want to drink.
Give me some examples.
I've had a mushroom beer, you know. But, you know, you don't necessarily have to do that. If it's something that you enjoy cooking with or eating with, you can try putting it in there. So, for example, you know, Sam Caligioni, the founder of Dogfish Head, was our keynote speaker yesterday at the conference. And he brought a beer called Beer de Provence, and it was a Saison, which is a Belgian-style farmhouse ale. And he used herbs de Provence that he'd experienced, and it was, I believe he explained it, it was a chicken dish, and they'd used these herbs, and it had this great flavor, and he was drinking a Saison. He's like, these would be really great together. And he used the herbs that they had used for cooking within the chicken in making this Saison, and it came through really, really well. Some of the spicy phenolic notes coming from that Saison yeast really paired well with the herbs that he was adding into the beer. And of course, you know, you'll filter them out, but they impart this interesting kind of combination of contrasts and complements of flavors. And so you can experiment with all those different things. So fruits, vegetables, you know, we talked about oak a little bit. We talked about, chocolates. What else?
Peppercorns, hot peppers, any kind of herbs and spices, honeys.
So at what point in the process do you incorporate, say, hot pepper?
Hot pepper generally is better during your fermentation process. Some people like to put it in at bottling time, so there's one in your bottle, but then it can get a little extra too hot. Mm-hmm. So if you put it in right after the fermentation, it will just, you can pull it out when you get the amount of heat that you want.
We talked about the, you know, those bad batches a little bit, and again, beer's a learning process, and I think a big tip to take away is take notes. You know, if you make a beer and you taste it and the hot peppers is too much, look at your notes from that batch of beer, and you added it at this point, try adding it during a different time, because really, when you add those ingredients in varying varieties and quantities, is going to change how that beer comes out. And so part of the reason why people enjoy homebrewing is honing in on that proficiency and understanding how different flavors are going to come through in the final product.
And if you take notes and follow them carefully, Chris, will it? If I like that batch, mm-hmm. and I read my notes and I took careful notes, is the next batch going to turn out just the same?
Close. I don't know. It's really tough to produce identical beers. There are always a few, you know, an element here or there that could be off for you. Again, temperature being one. But you can get pretty darn close.
And so that's where I'll disagree, because I think that if you can manage something like fermentation or like temperature and all of those variables that go into brewing, you know, it's a science. And if you keep them the same each time, it's going to come out tasting the exact same way. But I think,
with
like
good
you
equipment,
said,
absolutely.
Sometimes you can struggle with temperature if you don't have a place to ferment your beer that you can maintain that temperature.
What is the weirdest beer you've ever made, Chris? Either one of you.
I'm not that strange when it comes to, I'm pretty traditional. A strawberry Hefeweizen.
A Hefeweizen means something
white. It's a German wheat beer.
It's a wheat beer.
Yes.
And you flavored it with strawberries.
Yes.
That sounds very nice to me, but you're looking askance. I don't think
I'm not big into fruit beers.
How about you? What's the weirdest?
So prior to last week, it wasn't that weird. It was really just like a bourbon barrel aged imperial stout. That's not that weird, I think, when it comes
What?
Bourbon barrel aged imperial stout. So it was actually using oak that had been soaked in bourbon and then putting those oak cubes onto the imperial stout, which is really this rich, chocolatey, you know, boozy stout. But we recently brewed a beer that we're going to be adding a tiramisu hazelnut flavoring to, and that should be an interesting one.
It's not ready yet. You haven't.
It's not quite ready yet, so I'll have to let you guys know afterwards.
Rebecca is calling us from Timonium with a question. Rebecca, welcome to Midday.
Hi, I'm sorry. I want to learn to make Creek beer.
Creek. Mm.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
cherry beer.
Okay, thanks for the question, Rebecca. Is there a quick answer to Rebecca?
Creek's a cherry lambic, correct?
Correct.
Which is a sour type of beer. I'd say a great resource is, I mean, of course, we have articles on it on our website, homebrewersassociation.org. We actually have all of the gold medal winning recipes from the National Homebrew Competition for the last 10 years on our website, and that includes Creek recipes. So we actually have a gold medal winning Creek recipe on our website that you can access, and it'll tell you step-by-step how to make that beer and basically induce that sour lactic fermentation, and it's going to taste great.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. We're almost out of time, but Jace, can you pose your question quickly? Jace is calling us from Perry Hall.
Yeah, of course. So always striving to be efficient, I wonder if you could touch quickly on how to utilize water more efficiently.
How to use water more efficiently.
Ooh, I know.
Are you talking about the waste of the water, like during the chilling process?
Throughout the whole brewing process, trying to be more efficient with my water usage.
Sure.
Well, when you're chilling, I mean, you can reuse that water in the garden for sure. You could have several chillers in line, one in an ice bucket. That would help speed up the cooling process for you. Using sanitizers like Star San, you can keep them in a glass container and just keep an eye on your pH and reuse it over and over again. That would be two fairly easy ways to minimize the use of water.
Jace, I appreciate the question. We are almost out of time. Real quickly, what is session beer and why is it called that?
So sessionable or session beers are the term that's being used nowadays for beers that are lower in alcohol content. And so I think the idea is that you can have a beer in a session and maybe consume more one, and you look at perhaps the alcohol content of this beer, it's 7% ABV, where perhaps a sessional beer is going to be something more like 3.5% to 4%. And so you can have a couple of those beers without feeling the effects of all that alcohol.
So it has to do with your drinking session. It's nothing about how the brewing, except that it's brewed low alcohol.
When you see a beer that indicates that it's a session, whatever style, it indicates that it's going to be a little bit lower in alcohol.
A lot to learn about home brewing, and I really appreciate your giving us some insight into this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Steve Parr is Assistant Director of the American Homebrewers Association. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Chris Anderson, General Manager of Maryland Homebrew. Thanks for taking a break from the conference to come talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. On Monday, we're going to have an interesting show. A few years ago, Makita Brotman did something many of us have done. She started a book club. She's a scholar, a critic, and a psychoanalyst. And the book club she started was inside Maryland's maximum security prison. So on Monday, we'll talk to her and to one of her readers. That should be interesting. That's on Monday. I'm Sheila Cast. Meanwhile, I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thank you for listening to Midday, and join us again on Monday.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.